can be a great people color they wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all this reason, their capacity for good. I have sent them you. My only son.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
And welcome to issue 48 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that's better down where it's wetter. I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
And joining us for the first time in the studio, at least on this show, is our good friend David Longo from damngoodcup.com.
That's it. That's the one. Yeah.
It's a damn good cup.
It's a damn good cup. It's so damn good that I almost missaid it.
Wait a minute. We have a guest in studio and you didn't tell me?
Yeah, look, we snuck him in at the last minute, David. Now, we've got two Davids here, which is going to confuse me no end. So for the purposes of this show, I'm going to call you Stuart.
Okay.
No, actually.
I think we'll just call him Longo. What do you reckon?
Call him Longo.
No, don't.
I'll just whack you over the side.
No, I think it's very much a David and Dave situation.
David and Dave. Okay. Are we happy with that?
Yeah.
So if you're listening, viewers,
tonight's David will be played by David. And Dave
so
will be played by David.
David will sound a little like this.
Hello, I'm David.
And Dave will sound a little like this.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
And we'll see them later in the show playing completely different characters.
Thanks. Later, I'll be playing Richard Gray.
We're playing Richard.
That'll really just mess you up. You know,
it's really dark in here.
But the other things we're going to do in this issue, we're going to prepare for Oz Comic Con, plus a legend leaves Green Lantern, and Marvel sends us to infinity and beyond for free. DC cancels more, and more Arkham Asylum is on the way, then Guardians of the Galaxy casting, and a whole mess of TV news from The Walking Dead, Arrow, and S.H.I.E.L.D., plus our kick-ass pick of the week, The Underwater Welder by Jeff Lemire. This is Behind the Panels.
Longer than a whale, he can swim anywhere.
He can breathe underwater and go flying through the air.
The Jolo Submariner, ripped off her feet, will be wearing any demon.
Lord Famer of Atlantis is the prince of the deep.
Where do you get those wonderful toys?
It's a bit of a nautical theme this week because we're doing The Underwater Welder from Jeff Lemire. And if you haven't checked it out already, we put it out as a special, a full interview with Jeff Lemire about this book, but also mainly about his work on the excellent new issue of Green Arrow, Green Arrow 17. And he's on that title permanently, he said, for a while, at least for the near future. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get up to what we've been reading and watching. But Dave, this is your first time on Behind the Panel, so we have some ritual hazing to get. No, we don't have any.
I'm ready.
Dave, do we have the ritual hazing stick?
I wasn't ready.
I'll find out why it's called Behind the Panels.
Just hang on to your lariat.
And that's all we ask you to do.
And when you approach me with something like that, all I can think is,
it's really dark in here.
You were wonderful.
I should have brought a soundboard myself.
Oh, get used to it.
Should we just swiftly move on to the vintage clip of the week so we can avoid all this unpleasantness?
Might be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay, so keeping with our nautical theme this week, try a little bit of this on to size.
Deep in the ocean depths, a strange submarine craft with the bat wing shape of a manta ray glides soundlessly, as if stalking its prey. Within its sleek black hull, a crew of fearsome manta men led by Black Manta, Aquaman's archfoe, sets a lethal trap for the king of the seas.
What is Aquaman's position now?
Our sonar indicates he is coming into scanner range.
There they are. Activate the whale's brain scrambler now!
What's the matter, Aquaman?
I don't know. The fish are trying to tell me something.
Look! A whale! Running berserk!
Don't worry. I'll handle him.
Instantly, from the Sea King's brain, telepathic commands radiate toward the giant sea creature.
Don't waste your effort, Aquaman. Your telecommands can't get through my electronic impulses to the whale.
Oh, dear!
Can't understand why that whale didn't heed my command.
Here he comes again.
Watch out! Move, Mira, fast!
Duck, Tadpole! Duck!
Holy hurricanes, Aquaman! Look there!
Uh-oh. That's Black Manta's sea saucer.
I've toyed with them long enough. Now to turn on all the juice.
All right, three things immediately come to mind. First of all, did he really say that's his submarine crap at the beginning? Okay. Secondly, why is it the Black Manta sounds like something you'd buy from Adam and Eve? Right. And third thing, was that sound effect lifted from Deliverance?
Squeal, biggie.
You got a pretty mouth.
So, activate the whale's brain.
That's right,
scramble
Temple.
The whale's brain. Really?
Now I'll turn on all the juice.
And once again, something you would buy from Adam and Eve, right?
Oh, dear. Now, that was from the Superman Aquaman Hour of Adventure.
Of course it was.
1967, from an episode called The Menace of the Black Manta. And really, people, if you
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. If you own a Black Manta and it starts going wrong, take it back to the store you bought it at. It might just need new batteries. So,
God, it's hot in here, isn't it?
Should just move on to something slightly cleaner.
Where? Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Read between the lines, bitch.
People, we've probably been reading and watching a few things since we last met. Now, let's start with our guest. What have you been reading?
Well, besides the plethora of Marvel Now and New 52 titles, I mean, get closer. Yeah. Sorry, guys. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about Amazing Spider-Man, the final. And how it's moved on into Superior Spider-Man. Have you guys read?
Well, now it's funny you should mention this because last episode, Richard hadn't read Superior Spider-Man at this point, and I had, and basically saying, isn't it really interesting that we have no Peter Parker in the current Marvel?
I stand by this statement.
And I kept saying, read Superior Spider-Man.
My statement was, if you go back and listen to last week's episode, I actually said, we don't actually have a Peter Parker. It doesn't look like we're going to have a Peter Parker in either the Ultimate or May or 616 universes. At least not a Peter Parker as we know him.
You just had to wait 1 week.
Yeah. Now,
as we say at the beginning of every episode, spoilers and all for comic books. Now, with television, we're a little bit more careful. But with comic books, we talk spoilers here. Mm. And the last couple of panels of Superior Spider-Man number one... Mm-hmm. was an eye-opener. This is where, because when I first heard about Superior Spider-Man and I heard about the ending of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, I went, this is the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
Use the Force, Doc.
I thought this was the stupidest idea ever, that Dr. Octopus takes over his body and all that sort of crap. And I thought, what the hell are they thinking with this? But with those last couple of panels, they turned me around. Mm. In that one fail swoop, I went, this is kind of an interesting idea.
Because I was really negative on it.
Me too.
I guess against my better judgment, I actually really like
it. It's actually a really solidly written book.
I actually love the fact that in all rights, Octopus is actually being a better Spider-Man.
Yes, yeah. And I love this whole running thing of like the, you know, Doc Ock has more luck than Peter Parker and like even J. Jonah Jameson is. You know,
and I love the fact that even Octavius is basically in his internal monologues is going, why is it I always lost?
Yeah.
Why is it I always lost? And now, you know, and he's kind of going, oh, maybe this is why I always lost. You know, it's like he's starting to see the other side of all of this, you know. And I think it's actually a really solidly written book.
Mm.
You know?
I agree. And it's actually getting back in a strange way. It's getting back to that core of with great power comes great responsibility, which was always been the heart of that book. But you kind of lost that a bit over the years with all the various crossovers and things that they've done. And this is, strangely enough, taking Peter Parker out of the equation briefly actually makes his great power, great responsibility thing even more pertinent with a new person in his body, and he's still there lurking around.
Now, this is not to say that I don't want this story arc to end. I want this story arc to end. I want Parker back.
How long do you think it'll be till that?
They could milk this for a year easy. They could milk this for 12
Because the funny thing is, it's like, you know, here is he's deaf in 700, and then a week later, he's back. So that's kind of like a real quick jump. Do you think, like,
I don't think
anybody really race through out of some kind of fear, or
I don't think anybody would ever have suspected like Peter Parker would disappear from the book forever, you know, and I think, you know,
well, it's comic books,
it's comic books, but I think even when Superman died, like that was a year and a half or something before they brought him back onto the book. There were hints that he was coming back, and they had these four other Supermen running around at different times and stuff, but like even that, they had the teaser, like he's right, like Peter Parker is effectively back on panel
the next month,
yeah. Next month, not even before the end of that next issue,
yeah, you
know? So look, you know, I think we all know Peter Parker's coming back, but I think there's still a few surprises.
But also, judging by how long it has taken for the Guardians to actually manifest this year, we know that Bendis has been writing it and Niven has been drawing it for the last few months because leaked panels have been coming out. So comic books take time to make. This was no rash decision. They had this planned out in advance. They knew Parker was going to be in that last panel. They knew going into this what the story arc is. So, and my prediction is the story arc will be, I don't know, 6 to 12 issues, and Parker will regain control, but the experience will make him a better Spider-Man.
Mm.
I think that's the concept that we're going for here. The question is, does Octavius come back? Are we seeing the end of Octavius?
What's
going to
happen
this,
is they'll make a deal with the devil and they'll take
it
all
God,
back.
I hope they don't.
Just one more day.
J. Michael Straczynski needs to take over the run. And we will have Mephisto back in it again. And off we go.
Maybe this will be Mary Jane's get out of jail card. She's like, actually, this is what I whispered about. What I was saying is, if Doc Ock ever takes over,
I want him.
So. And like they're going to get it on pretty quickly, I think. So.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, it looks like maybe not. Because there was that. Have you read the
The
whole date issue where
they had the worst date, I think.
Yeah. So I'm and how Parker is so relieved at like, oh thank God he's
but
not
I mean,
yeah. pursuing
that's
that.
What I'm saying. Like it's back to pure Peter trying to juggle a relationship, or you know, Spider-Man trying to juggle a relationship with being Spider-Man, with trying to do all this stuff. And even with Doc Ock's superior brain, he can't juggle all those things that Peter Parker could.
And I love that where she goes, where Mary Jane says, oh my God, there's sirens, shouldn't you be going? And he goes, no, it's okay. It's fine.
I got it covered. It's fine.
It's an interesting run. I don't know how long they can milk it, but it's an interesting run so far. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, people.
Yes.
Oh, well, the elephant on the tray.
Or on the tray, we should say. Yes, the elephant on the tray.
Or the trays.
Trays, yes. Batman 17 came out. This is probably the read of the month.
Look, it's Batman's been the read of the last 17 months.
Yes.
And now this is Snyder's proved once again that he can do two back-to-back major events. And I can't wait to see whatever the next one is.
Now, once again, we'll throw in that spoiler warning because this is probably the biggest spoiler of all because this has been a big build-up.
By the time the show's out, you've had a good read, a week.
You've had a week and a half.
If you haven't, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. I figure if you haven't picked it up by now, you probably weren't reading the series anyway. But... So the trays were revealed. We talked about this in the Lemire interview as well. Lemire basically said,
and Lemire said it was going to be Batman's head.
Yeah, and he wasn't far off.
Oh, no,
he wasn't far off. So what was your initial reaction when those trays were lifted? Did you think it was? Did you wonder how far he would go?
Well, because of what he's done before, and I've also been reading like a lot of Scott Snyder stuff, like American Vampire as well. You know, he tends to really push it. And so you're sitting there and you're going, oh my God, he's going to do this. He's going to do it. And that's kind of the beauty of the issue is that he does do it.
Because the book is called Death of the Family.
So.
Even if at the end, you know, it's revealed, you know, we'll get to that. But you still have that feeling that he did do it for those 10 pages.
I was like, back in my mind, I was thinking, no, this is going to be fake. But part of me was still going... Shit, he's done this, hasn't he?
Right, so we're dancing around.
I reckon it would have been amazing, just quickly. Yeah. It would have been amazing if they'd all swap writers for all the other Death of the Family titles.
That would have been interesting too. So what we should reveal is basically what was on the trays were the faces of the family. Each tray was their face and they were all bandaged up. My reaction when I read it, my first reaction that came out of me as soon as I read that page was, how are we going to surgically reattach these faces?
I know, you're sitting there reading the next five pages... back of your mind is thinking, well, they're going to have to sew them back on. And you know,
are they going to have scars for the rest of the issues? Yeah. It's like, this is really traumatic. I mean, it's like, you sit there going, this is unbelievable that they went here.
Yeah.
Especially when he poked at one of the faces. And it's like, you're sitting there going, he's actually done this.
Do you guys think that they were people's faces?
Oh, yeah. He ripped those faces off of somebody.
They had to be real faces, didn't they? Yeah.
Because they're sitting there in the ice tray with a bit of blood around them. And
what
stuff.
I actually love is the fact that he left all the masks on.
Yeah.
So it really did. It was that indication that Joker really didn't care who they were underneath.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He really didn't care who they were under masks. The masks were the people to him.
Yeah.
You know? And so when he ripped the faces off, or theoretically ripped the faces off, they were intact with masks and cowls on in place. And I thought that was a fascinating idea.
And it harkens back to the, you know, the Dark Knight Returns kind of thing. Of, you know,
well,
the,
it does.
The Joker doesn't care about
Bruce Wayne.
Bruce Wayne at all.
Yes. You know. And also, it kind of harkens back to this whole concept that he really didn't know who they were. He didn't have this insider information that they all think he had. The book's pages were empty. You know, it's like, and Bruce having in that internal monologue at the end basically saying he didn't want to know. Joker's never wanted to know. He doesn't care about the secret identities. He just cares about the masks. He just cares about his foes, and his foes are Batman and company, you know? So it's brilliant writing. A brilliant piece of writing.
I want to ask you guys, though, how would you have felt if it was Alfred's head?
I think I actually probably would have thrown the book across the room. I was really ready for that.
Because that's the thing going through my head is like that. After reading it, I thought to myself, "What if he'd actually taken someone out?"
Yeah,
I probably wouldn't have felt as good about the book.
And I think that's what's been great about Snyder. He's pushed a lot of boundaries, like you said, but he knows when to stop because he knows when fans will turn against him. If he killed off a staple character, I think people would go, "Okay, this is sensationalism."
Yeah.
And as it is sensational, but it's just without the ism.
Yeah. You know? well put, sir.
Should have been,
I want that.
Mr. That's, Terrific's
here on the trade. It'll be on the hardcover trade of this. It's sensational without the ism.
I want a t-shirt that says sensational, no ism.
Yeah.
But that could be easily manipulated. Anyway. I won't go. Sorry, it's that Black Manta reference again.
There it is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Richard's got it out on.
I've got my copy open here in front. And look, you know, there's
the artwork, man.
The artwork in this is, as always, Greg Capullo. It's been stunning throughout this whole, both like every saga he's done, the Night of the Owls, Court of the Owls, and this. That almost sort of Reichenbach Falls moment, that sort of Sherlock Holmes Moriarty moment. When they're standing at the top of it. I mean, because that is the relationship
absolutely,
that they have.
Yeah. I didn't make that connection. That's
yeah,
awesome.
And it's only because recently I'd been watching some Holmes, and I just sort of, you know, sort of him standing at the top of the waterfall holding the Joker, and he's like, no, I'm not going to lose you by accident. That's not how this is going to end, you know. And there's that kind of thing. But it's like Joker has planned this all out the same way Moriarty would have.
Yeah. So here's the question. The question is Joker finally gone?
Never.
At least maybe for a while.
No one's dead until you see the body. In fact, yeah, exactly it, Dave, because we haven't seen, until this arc, we hadn't seen the Joker since Detective Comics 1.
Yes.
True.
Of the new 52. And that had been a year and a half.
And in fact, almost. Scott Snyder actually said in, I think it was the Fat Man and Batman interview that he did, he actually said he purposely kept Joker out of it. He wanted to have a break from Joker. He wanted to get that distance so that when Joker came back, he could make him his version of the Joker. And I think this is probably what's going to happen again.
I think
now
we're getting a Riddler story.
Yeah, I've heard Riddler too.
Yeah, because he was kind of set up a bit in this arc. He was floating around.
And you're not going to bring back Penguin, because Penguin's been kicking around in Birds of Prey and stuff like that.
And
so
he had
gonna
his own miniseries.
Exactly.
And that awful arc in Catwoman.
Catwoman. And I think he was in Detective Comics or one of those other ones as well.
We had a whole bunch of them through Detective Comics, because Two-Face was there at one point, and there was a whole bunch of them came through at one point. Riddler is a good choice, because Enigma is always a very interesting character anyway, because he's kind of conflicted.
And I think that this is the best thing about the Joker, is that he's a character that works well in small doses, because if you overexpose him, you know, he becomes a cartoon version of himself. He becomes the parody version of himself. The best Jokers we've seen are in those one shots, your killing joke type deals, or or even your, you know, even Dark Knight Returns, that kind of stuff. It's like, it's when the Joker becomes as big as Batman in his myth, you know. Anything else we've been reading we want to talk about quickly before we move on?
Look, my week has really been kind of tied up with catching up, in particular on making sure I had everything caught up on the Batman beforehand. The other one I wanted to talk about was Batgirl very quickly, because Batgirl, throughout the death of the family, has been bringing her brother into the fold. At one point, I think we actually said in the last issue, we actually kind of suspected maybe the Joker was the brother, because we were saying, was it really the Joker?
That's one thing we didn't touch upon. Like, all throughout the death of the family run, there was the question of whether or not
it was the real Joker.
They kept saying, it's not like him. It's different.
Everybody kept saying, he's not the same person.
Which I'm so glad it was him.
Yeah.
And it could have been, because you know, someone's face stapled onto, you know.
Absolutely. So now we've finished that arc with the latest Batgirl. We've now gone straight into the James arc with her, and we're going to see some very interesting stuff with that, because Batgirl's out for vengeance now. She's really, because the mother is now in hospital missing a finger and traumatized because of all of this as well. So there's some really interesting stuff in the entire Bat universe, and the repercussions of the Court of Owls, and then now with Death of the Family. They're damaged characters now in many ways. So it's like just a finale of Batman 17 with them all declining.
I think that's what makes it him. Such a great event. You know, one of the best events, if not the best event of the New 52 entirely, is that it actually has an impact.
Yeah, and a lot can be said for that when you consider how many events have been happening.
Yeah,
and I mean, I think we should touch briefly upon the fact we also I haven't read the last couple of issues, but you have. We resolved the Rot World saga, which is the Swamp Thing and Animal Man crossover, which I was actually getting bored with. Mm. It was dragging on. It was getting to a point where I was kind of going, really? you know, it's like, come on, can we just wrap this up now? So, what were the impressions of the finale?
Of Rotworld?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say first, going into it, it's like I liked Animal Man a lot, and I liked Swamp Thing.
And I actually like Swamp Thing more than Animal Man.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah, see, I was always more Swamp Thing.
Now I'm kind of reevaluating it coming through this, because my experience of Rotworld was every week that they came out, every month, you got them on the same day.
Mm.
You got Animal Man and Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
So you had to read them in a specific order. But for me, I came out of every week just going, which do I like better?
Yeah.
Which character do I like better? Because they didn't team up till like halfway through the event and so forth. But my impression of it, that the artwork throughout it was just awesome. And part of me loves it for that alone. Just that the way that they did all these mutant, you know, superheroes that we all know. And all these little things like that. I really appreciate it. But when you come to the end, you find out that it's pretty empty.
Yeah.
You know, then it in particular, the ending is just an excuse to start another one, event.
Swamp Thing is Snyder, isn't it?
Yes.
Swamp Thing's
Snyder. Yeah, Swamp Thing is Snyder. And it just shows you there's a radical difference between his writing, between Swamp Thing and Batman.
Absolutely, And American Vampire, too.
Yeah. And so it's really interesting. It almost feels like his heart is not entirely in Swamp Thing. And maybe that's because Batman is taking so much of his time. I don't know.
No, but he's still on Swamp Thing, isn't he? Going forward. Yes. Which if he's going to
I don't know if it's for too much longer, though.
I know, because he's starting up the new Superman book.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because that'd be 4 monthly titles. And that's a hell of a... That's Bendis level.
Yeah. And American Vampire's gone on hiatus.
Yeah, that's right. It has to.
Until next year, I think.
Which is not surprising, given all the other books starting up. Right. So, yeah.
So, it's interesting. I just find it interesting that we've had these two major events through the DC. There's three total, with also Hell on Earth, which is also dragging on way too long.
Yeah.
But that's got to come to a conclusion, because Superman's being taken over by Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
Is he taking over the Superman book, or is he coming out with a new title?
New title.
Man of Steel, I think.
And who's it?
It's Jim Lee.
Jim Lee's the artist. Yes, it's going to be a superstar team. And meanwhile, Action Comics is being taken over by Andy Diggle.
That's right. Well, it's because Grant Morrison has already basically said that he's leaving Capes. He's going off to his own stuff. So he's leaving superheroes, which I don't think is, in a personal opinion, is not actually a moment too soon. I think when you look at his personal stuff, Happy, as an example, is magnificent.
Which we will do on an upcoming show.
Yeah, once we get a last issue. We're still waiting for last issue. But his Cape stuff has left a lot to be desired lately. I think his heart's not in it, and you can really feel that. His heart's just not in the Capes anymore.
Do you think there's a potential that he's said pretty much everything he can at this point with superheroes? I think it seems more like a decision that he's made knowingly. He's not forced out of it or anything. I think he's got to that point where he's like, I'm pretty much said everything I can.
Probably.
All right, before we move on from what we've been reading and watching, I actually realized I completely forgot to play the theme song before we got into this.
But through the miracle of post-production, should I put it in?
You can absolutely put that in, David.
So you would have actually heard it, and now you're wondering what we're talking about.
Exactly. But also what we've been watching, a couple of things have come back in the last few weeks. Obviously, Arrow's been back on the CW for a few weeks, and this week, and that's just been renewed for a second season, which we're very pleased to hear about. We've got a link to a few stories about those in our show notes. Also, Walking Dead came back this week. Now, we won't get into that too much because we know you don't like spoilers, but it debuted to well over 12 million viewers.
That's amazing.
Which cracked its season 3. This is the mid-season debut. This is the season 3 debut was just over 10 million.
Mm.
So it's gained people throughout, and that was already a record. And it's gained another 2 million people throughout this season. Not for nothing. This is a cracker of a series. This keeps picking up. Now, the problem is, though, it's starting to show some of the cracks that the comic book is showing, I'm thinking. Wash, rinse, repeat a little bit. And it's painted itself into a little bit of a corner because it's killed off a few characters that would have been doing some linchpin stuff now, or it needs other things. It's going in an interesting direction. I can feel Dave chomping at the bit next to me, wanting to say something at this stage.
I don't know if I should.
How about this? How about this for a deal? Mm-hmm. Okay, there's only what, 6 episodes or 7 episodes left.
About that. Yeah.
Okay. How about in 6 or 7 weeks we reconvene and we have a spoilers and all wrap up of season 2?
We'll do a Walking Dead special, and we see, well, we said we were going to come back and do the Walking Dead again because I think we did the first 10-15 issues last time we spoke about
this. So what we'll
do
is we'll talk about the next story arc throughout the prison of the comic book. We'll make that the book of the week, and we will talk about season 3 spoilers and all.
Excellent.
All right.
Just to tease that, I'm so negative on it. It's amazing.
Well, it'll be very interesting. It'll be very interesting to talk because I don't know if anybody remembers going back to Film Actually and the specials we also ran on that. I was incredibly negative on season 1 and 2, so I've actually had a lot of experience with bagging out this show. Yep.
I know you've got problems with season.
I've got a lot of problems with it, but I've actually been kind of on board for this season. They turned me around in the last episode, last couple of episodes of season 2. And I've been okay with this season, although I agree with Richard. We've reached a point where, because we've made so many tweaks and changes, it's not working the same way.
Yeah.
And the way it worked in the comic book was so mad. Arguably, this is the best arc of the comic books.
This is
the standout moment in the comic books where you go, the governor, the prison, this is when people think about Walking Dead, this is what they think
about. They never could have done on screen.
They have done it horribly.
Yeah.
I'm so adamant about that. Well, because the thing about the comic book that makes it so amazing...
No spoilers now.
Okay? I won't spoil anything, I promise. I won't spoil anything. What makes it so amazing is that it's the whole idea of that in an apocalypse, it's the human beings that are the worst thing. We become the worst thing.
Yeah.
Whereas in the show, still, and especially how they've handled the governor, the humans are still not as bad as the apocalypse.
The governor's too nice.
And that's the thing. The governor is way too nice.
The governor, as we talked about this last issue, the governor as shown in the comic book is this slimy, sleazy guy.
70s
bad porn stash. You know,
he was
horrible, and there's something horrible about him from the minute they meet him.
Oh, by the time he comes back in the comic, the second time he comes back, he looks like a Garth Ennis victim.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and this is precisely
and then in the comic book, you've got all the torture of Michonne, you've got the torture of Rick, you've got the rape. And this was a really hard comic book to read. There were many times where I almost want to put the comic book down and say, I'm not going back to this. This is horrible.
And there are scenes, I mean, like minor spoilers for the TV show. This is in the most recent episode, and this is just a very, very minor spoiler, where a line, Glenn says something about, do you know what he did to her, referring to Maggie? And it's like, it didn't look that bad in the TV show.
Well, and in fact,
like, you know, what,
and in fact,
know.
This is actually going back to before the season break, so it's not really spoiling anything of the new episode, but they didn't really do anything to Maggie.
Exactly, and where the
nothing happens to anyone.
No, and in the comic, some horrible things happen to some good people, and violence, as you said, Dave, violence breeds violence because it's kind of the whole thing. Humans are bad, and the situation made them worse. They're responding to it with violence, and it all escalates. And it would have been great if Walking Dead had finished about 10, the comic had finished about 10 issues after that.
Yeah.
So it would have ended on this horribly dark, but maybe a glimmer of hope thing, but it never did, and it's just gone on into eternal bleakness.
Well, exactly. And I've actually said for a long time that I think Walking Dead is probably about 40 issues over its due date anyway. It's over its expiry date. Because we're in the wash, rinse, and repeat
for a long time. Issue 60.
I'm in disagreement, but
that's okay. Fine. Yeah. But
I'm not saying the comic book's perfect either.
No,
I do see a lot of your points.
I actually still really enjoy the comic.
And the comic is good because it's so well written in the sense that the characters are so well defined, and I mean, there's great stuff in it. But there is no denying that what the formula of the comic book now is trudge, find a place. Everything starts to look up. It all falls apart. Trudge. They find a place. Everything starts to look up. It all falls apart. Trudge. It's exactly the same cycle over and over and over again. And
I feel like that's kind of the point of it, though.
Yeah, but the problem is you get to a point where you go, okay, we know what's going to happen now. We know it's... As soon as they go, let's plant some crops, we go, oh, it's going to turn to hell in a few years. So.
Someone's going to invade. Like,
somebody's going to die.
But see, here's the thing. It's like the comic book has been doing that for how many issues now?
107? Right?
Yeah. Whereas the show is like literally at, what, issue 20-something?
Well, less. I think it's like issue 18, 19.
And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about here. Like, you know, and let's just fire another showrunner.
But that was that was the best news. Yeah. The second showrunner. and when it was picking up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but that's my feeling about the show in general. Not to talk about it too much longer, but it's like, it starts, every episode starts great, and then when it does that whole do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, you're like, this is going to be a good episode.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then halfway through, you're like, oh, what are they doing? What are they doing? And then you're like, this is really bad.
And
then you get to the end of the episode, and you're like, next week could be good.
Yeah, but this is a series that did spend half a season looking for a girl in the woods.
Yes.
All right, that was like a page and a half in a comic book.
And then when they found her, it was awesome.
But that's when the
second season really picked up.
From that episode, the last three episodes of that season, it's like, oh, okay, we're back.
But that was like what, 8 episodes in or something?
I'm gonna throw the ball back. Like, you're saying this show that races through like the prison stuff, but yet it drags out.
I know.
The farm. Yeah, and it's like, where are the...
My thought was you could have got to the prison and you could have spent an entire season building that prison stuff and building really good characters, because that's what this show was like.
Mm.
What we have is sorry, guys, this is from the beginning of the season, so not since this new episode has just aired, but we have them find the prison, and then literally within minutes of them finding the prison, the helicopter flies over and you go... Hang on a minute.
Yeah. Because they've introduced Tyrese into the show now.
Yeah.
He should have been back in the farm. Yeah. You know? But they already had a black guy then.
I still think they need to introduce Michonne. And then, and I know they have, but like, and they need to introduce Andrea,
and she's awesome. And the thing is, you sit there going,
"She's not.
I mean, she's awesome. The actress is awesome. The look, they got everything about her right from her first appearance with the zombies on chains. And you sit there and go, here she is. Yeah. Why isn't she meeting anybody?
I'm back here. I'm walking around now and wait. Oh, wait, it's been 30 minutes since we've killed some zombies.
The entire Andrea arc has been completely spoiled.
Rubbish.
Andrea is such a good character in the comic book. Such a good character in the comic book.
Oh, I want to throttle her every episode.
And you sit there and go, this is not Andrea. This has got nothing to do with the... She goes, oh, I'm a pretty good shot. It's like, in the comic book, you're better.
Yeah. Didn't you love that scene, though? Like, it's like, I'm a pretty good shot. And then she just like walks like 10 meters and just gets a handgun out and just caps someone who's on the floor. You know? You're like, wow, great. You know,
it's good. You can shoot someone at point blank range. Awesome.
Yeah. Excellent.
Now, on to something slightly more positive. Arrow is the greatest. Look, apart from the fact that it is actually doing something very different from the source material. It is, even though it's very much based on the Grell kind of era and it's got a few influences there, it's taken a lot of liberties with the source material as well. It's a case where that is working incredibly well on screen.
Well, yeah, because I don't think they're actually following an arc either.
No.
Walking Dead tells a very specific story. And when you say you're going to make an adaptation, you're following that storyline. Mm-hmm. Arrow being like Superman or like Batman or like anything else, there's so many storylines.
Yeah,
we're basically taking a character and we're doing a new story. They've done
their own thing, but the clever thing is they're slowly pulling in characters from the DCU in their own way, like we've got, and Green Arrow history. In the last, minor spoilers here, people, we've got, we've known about Deathstroke for quite some time.
Yep.
They've introduced a character from
they've kind of flipped that on its head, though.
Which is quite clever, the way they've done that. They've introduced a character from the Longbow Hunters. I won't say who, because that is a major spoiler for people who haven't seen it yet, and I can't wait to see how that plays out.
Right.
That's one of my favorite Green Arrow stories ever. And if that comes back, it'll certainly make his relationship with Laurel quite interesting. if it goes the same way as the Longbow Hunters, I'm loving the way they're pulling this in. I won't speak because I it's basically a fan fest for the show every week, so I won't say too much more, but. Honestly, the latest episode, it's just been renewed for a second season, and I can't wait.
It's like, a show I look forward to every week.
Every week. It's a shame that the ratings have dropped slightly.
It's
still just under 3 million.
What does it rate?
So, it rates just under 3 million. 3 million.
Yeah, it rated really high in its first.
It was like 4-point-something in the first.
I think the mid-season break may have hurt it a little bit, took its momentum away. It's been kind of... I hate to say abused, but it's been a little bit abused by the fact that it's not being released worldwide simultaneously.
You know, and I'll just get on my soapbox here. Channel 9 in Australia have bought this, and they were advertising it heavily late last year for either a late 2012, early 2013 debut. Here we are, 14 episodes in, still no release date in Australia. This thing will be out on DVD, Blu-ray in the States.
It's
by the
supposed
time.
To be. It's supposed to be mid-February.
Mid-February
was the last I heard. And we're mid-February, guys.
We're mid-February. There's still no release date, as far as I know, on this thing. I wouldn't be surprised if they hold it out, shuttle it off to one of their sub-channels like Go, or if we do see it, they'll do what they did with Star Trek back in the day, which is release it, stick it on at 11 o'clock at
11
night,
o'clock,
slowly yeah. push it back, and it'll get no audience.
What they'll do is they'll give it the Buffy Star Trek treatment. They'll show it at prime time for 2 episodes,
yep,
and then shuffle it down to 11 o'clock at night, because they'll go, oh, it's geek viewing.
Yeah,
and then they'll use that as ammunition. They'll say, it only got like 200 viewers on it.
It never found an audience. What's because the audience couldn't find it.
Yeah,
you know, and it's that thing you see it in, and we see it in the US all the time, but. It's unfortunate. Genre TV in Australia has never done well on the networks.
No, God forbid you try and preempt the cricket.
Yeah, but which is why they've been so clever with Walking Dead on Foxtel and on subscription TV. It's fast tracked 33 hours now, which is not super fast, but given that it took us like over a year to get the first season out here on TV. 33 hours is pretty fast.
Yeah.
It's a really fast rowboat that things in this time. To get out here. You know, we've got out here. They've also got it on iTunes available. There's plenty of opportunities
See,
to get it legally.
The difference is, though, that FX that shows, not FX, sorry, I take that back, AMC that shows it in the States.
It's FX,
FX here. AMC is still a cable channel. So this is subscription television, no matter which way you slice it. And so subscription over there, it's subscription over here. They can mess with it any way they want.
Exactly.
Arrow is network television, and network television free to air, and it's coming to a free to air channel here, and our free to air channels barely talk to each other. You know, and that's the problem. I mean, when they do fast track, they choose to fast track stuff like Bionic Woman, which basically dies after 7 episodes.
Fast track here just hasn't worked. It's a bit of a joke.
We still don't have Netflix or anything like that.
No,
we have QuickFlix, which is the Netflix equivalent, but their catalog isn't huge.
But it's a licensing thing, because they're not going to get stuff. I did actually see QuickFlix have made a deal, I think, with HBO.
Oh, very nice.
And I think a lot of stuff's going to be like coming out.
Oh, actually, I noticed that. Yes, their streaming service has Hung and stuff like that on it now. So
yeah, and it's like, but it's new stuff as well, as apparently going to be coming. So a little bit of hope, because HBO is one that we all, you know.
And if you are a QuickFlix subscriber and you have an Xbox, you can get QuickFlix on your Xbox, so you can watch
on PS3 as well.
And PS3, so you can watch it on your high def screens and what have you. So you can stream some content.
But we need a Hulu. We need something like that.
Have you guys discovered Crackle?
No.
I've heard of Crackle.
Okay,
yeah,
Crackle
yeah.
is actually an app you can get for your iPad, iPhones. It's also on Xbox 360 and it's on PS3. It's actually run by Sony. It's a free streaming service. All you got to do is sign up for it. And it has hundreds of movies, television shows, all sorts of, all free.
Wow.
So if you see Crackle around, have a look at it. It's not all first run stuff, but there's a lot of content on there. So have a look, because you might find things that you're looking for on Crackle as well. But anyway, that's not
we're way
off the mark.
So that's the sponsorship money.
None of these people sponsor us.
Now I'll get us back on topic with a little bit of this.
What a scoop!
Wow, that theme coming in at 37 minutes is is something else. All right,
right. Speaking of sponsors, though, no. Speaking of sponsors,
if you'd like to sponsor behind us,
no, it's like The Walking Dead, we'd run way over.
Well, we're not. Yeah, we've been looking for Sophia for the last 37 minutes.
I nearly did a spit take there all over the.
That's what made me laugh. I'm watching your face. You almost exploded.
We're not being sponsored in any way by Oz Comic Con, because we haven't got anything yet. But we might be getting a few interviews with them, so we just want to give them a shout out.
But however,
say,
because it is Oz Comic Con, we'll always give them a shout.
Look, I mean, look, you know, and we're an Oz comic show.
Absolutely.
So we have to give a shout out to Oz Comic Con, who are in their second year, I believe, this year. Last year they had out Stan Lee. This year they've got out William Shatner and Richard Dean Anderson. So, you know, maybe not quite
I was going to bring out a Shatner impersonation, but I thought maybe not.
Well, David, you could if you wanted.
But for how long?
Can I get you to do an impression of Shatner for me?
No.
No? Come on. I heard recently he said, you know, he called J.J. Abrams out over the new, the new Star Trek. The Star Wars music.
Well, we've got another.
He called him a pig. I'd love to hear Dave just go,
"You are a pig."
Look, we've got some more impressions coming up later in the show, but Oz Comic Con is going to be hitting Adelaide and Perth very shortly. Perth hits on the 9th of March and the 10th of March, and you'll find that at the Perth Convention and Exhibition Centre. In Adelaide, it's on the 16th and 17th of March at the Adelaide Showgrounds. Go to ozcomiccon.com for all the details. Some of the guests include people like film and TV. You've got a bunch of people from Warehouse 13, Eddie McClintock. Oh, I said that badly. Aaron Ashmore. You've got, as we said, we've got Shatner and Richard Dean Anderson from heaps of different sci-fi shows on the way. Look, you know, your regular guest groups of people from DS9, Smallville, Dead Like Me, Angel, Eureka, all that kind of gear. You've got writing and comic guests include the likes of Sean Williams, who is a New York Times best-selling science fiction author and on Star Wars. Nicola Scott, who we love from things like Birds of Prey, Secret Six, Teen Titans, JSA, Doug Holgate, Stuart McKenney, and some voiceover guests. They always have a few of those. People like Chris Sabat, who is known from Dragon Ball Z. You know, it's a bit of fun. There'll also be exhibitions there. There'll be exhibitors. There'll be sponsors. So, look, if you like comics, I think this sort of thing is going to grow every year if people like you support it.
Absolutely.
Go along if you're in Perth and Adelaide. There's also a Melbourne version coming up, but that's not until July, and I'm guessing there'll be a different lineup of guests on that as well. Also to keep an eye out, Supernova's coming up soon, but we just wanted to give a shout-out to Oz Comic Con because it's very, very soon. The big comics news this week, the shocking comics news, the comics news that probably made us all fall off our chairs. Geoff Johns is leaving Green Lantern.
This is amazing. This is as big a news as when Bendis left Avengers. This is like, what? After setting everything up and running this universe for so many years, to just go, okay, I'm done.
Now, we knew something was up because when DC released all their solicitations by family, so you got them all out on the Friday, like the Batman family, the Superman family, all that, but they held over the Green Lantern solicits until the Monday. And it was like, something's going on here. There's a big event or something's happened. And it turned out it's because Johns is leaving Lantern. So he's been on it since 2004. So we're looking almost 9 years here when he did the 6-issue Green Lantern Rebirth miniseries, which basically brought back Hal Jordan into the world. Like he's saying, he's really proud of all the stuff he's built with Green Lantern, from Lafleeze to the different core.
Fleas is so good.
Yeah. who is turning up in Threshold at the moment, I think, as well as...
I haven't read Threshold yet. Yeah. Did you read the Lantern, just as a sidetrack, did you read the Lantern stories where they ended up in Vegas? And Lafleeze discovers Vegas, and of course they're all like, keep him away.
Basically, it comes down to, he says, like, he'd reached a point in the current story to step away and let someone else take over the writing. I was getting to an end point and a storyline that made sense for me. I felt like it was time to close my run and focus all my engines on the Justice League corner of the DC Universe.
Needs repairing, quite frankly.
Yeah, he said, noting that his stories were collaborative efforts with artists like editors like Ivan Reis, Joe Prado, Van Shiver, and Peter Tomasi, all who've done amazing work the last 8 years or so on that title. Look, we're going to be sorry to see him go. And the last, honestly, I've always said this, apart from Batman, Lantern's had the only DC title that's had its head screwed on straight as far as crossovers go and events go. So the whole thing with the introduction of Simon Baz, which is the first Muslim superhero.
Sorry, Lantern called Baz.
Baz. Baz the Green Lantern. Bazza.
Bazza. Yeah, mate.
Yeah, mate.
A lantern? Really?
What do you reckon? Charge this thing up? There's a thing they do on, what's it called, on Hollywood Babylon when they do the Green Lantern Oath.
Yeah.
In brightest day.
The John Lovitz.
In darkest night. Yeah.
No evil, mate.
No.
Yeah, mate.
Escaping my sight, just not on. Right. I'll skip this story. But Marvel, their big crossover that's coming up is Marvel's Infinity, which is going to bring back to the old Infinity stuff with Infinity Gauntlet. Yep. We've got a lot of Thanos coming up. If you're following Thanos, you're collecting half the books that are coming out in the next 6 months. Marvel this year with their free Comic Book Day book, which will be early May. It's usually the first Saturday in May. It's free Comic Book Day. But both DC and Marvel usually tease a big event. DC are teasing
Trinity,
but also their Superman book with... Diggle that we mentioned before, but also Marvel is teasing something called Infinity, which is going to be their free comic book day book, and it's also going to be essential reading because it's one of those books that will set up, you know, the next 6-7 months worth of stories.
Have you guys been reading New Avengers by any chance?
The new Avengers.
It's called the New
Avengers. Avengers.
Yeah, the Marvel Now New Avengers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. In the latest issue, they had a whole thing with the Infinity Gauntlet.
Yes.
And bringing the gems back together. And
yeah, so I think that's going to really inform, because I suspect that'll be in the movies as well. Mm. I think it's really going to inform with the return of Guardians, with the return of the Thanos Rising origin story, with Nova, with the whole cosmic emphasis. I think we're heading into another Infinity thing, because it's been a few years since we've had a big Infinity, you know, there was Infinity War and Infinity.
I think it's the Thanos Imperative.
Thanos Imperative was the last big time we saw. Yeah, Thanos Imperative was when we last saw the Guardians as well. Mm. So really looking forward to this stuff. So it's the book's going to be written by Jonathan Hickman, who's done things like Avengers and the Manhattan Projects, with art by Jim Chung, who did Avengers Children's Crusade. Really looking forward to it. This is one of those ones that's going to fly off the shelves, and you'll have to hit up eBay for it afterwards if you don't find it. So go and get this thing.
You got to say, that everything Marvel is doing is just...
They are doing the Midas touch at the moment. It is unbelievable. We were saying they took DC to school and how to relaunch a universe.
Well, speaking of which,
they still haven't got that.
Funny you should mention that.
DC launched their New 52, 17 issues ago?
Yep.
The newish 52, the newish, as we're fond of calling it on this show, Dave, it's the newish 52, is. The 52 titles are not the same 52 titles that launched 17 issues ago.
Actually, fact, quite a few.
They've cancelled a war book twice in that time. you know, but now they've cancelled another six coming up.
Do you know how many titles that they've cancelled since the original?
At least...
It's half. At least half of them have gone.
At least half, because there was six this... There's been at least six three times, I think. So there's at least 18 titles have been cancelled along the way.
Something, so, it's got to be. It's about half of the New 52 are no longer the New 52.
And
what gets me though is this story you're about to do, though, because we're about to cancel stuff that came in the second and third waves.
The books we're canceling, some of the original ones that have finally been canceled, include Fury of Firestorm, The Savage Hawkman, and Deathstroke. But they're also canceling things like Team 7, Sword of Sorcery, which is Amethyst stuff, and The Ravagers, which have only just come along in the last couple of waves. So they're all going to end in May.
I'd actually like to point out that Team 7 actually is only at issue 4.
Okay. Well, there you go. And so it'll make its way to a respectable 8 or something by the time it... Yeah.
It started at the 0 issues, if you remember.
Yeah, look. So 8 issues plus 0.
Yeah, exactly. So it's shameful. I mean, it's just shameful.
And 8 times 0, it still equals 0.
0.
Come on, you're being a bit harsh here. They're monthly books.
Now, what they're replacing it with is bizarre. Like, two of the books that they're going to fill the lineup are The Green Team and The Movement. Now, this is bizarre to me. The Movement's got some promise because it's written by Gail Simone and Freddie Williams III, who's doing the art. Now, according to this article, the Movement, Simone says, the Movement is an idea I've had for some time. It's a book about power, who owns it, who uses it, who suffers from its abuse as we increasingly move to an age where information is currency. You get these situations where a single viral video can cost a previously unassailable corporation billions.
I'm sorry, this sounds like Occupy DC.
Well, it is. And if you look at the posters, because the other book is... there's the Movement and there's the Green Team. Now, the Green Team has got this fist, this very propaganda-style poster with a fist and a like a Rolex watch and holding some money saying the Green Team, the Trillionaires by Art Balthazar Franco and I.G. Guerra. It says, money can buy them happiness and they want to share it with you. and it says, meet the 99% is the Movement. They were the superpower disenfranchised and now they're the voice of the people.
People.
Now, I have no idea what DC does. If DC, if there was a more rudderless company than DC at the moment, like, I mean, we talked about how Marvel has got this stuff back on track just by focusing on crazy things like great writers and artists.
What a concept.
And the books that they have rebooted have been for a reason. It's like, this is a jumping on point. It's not a reboot. It's just a renumbering because we want you to start here and we want you to start buying it. And the proof's in the pudding because people are.
And they didn't just unilaterally do it, because some of the books are actually still running. They're just saying, okay, this is your jumping on point.
Yeah.
At the point, the Lady Sif book, what's it called? Journey, Adventures?
Whatever.
Journey into Mystery.
That's the one. That's up to issue, whatever that's up to.
600
something. Yeah. But it's just gone, now it's Marvel now. And this is where you jump on.
Daredevil and Hawkeye.
Yeah, that's still gone. Yeah. Because you wouldn't want to mess with Daredevil.
Oh, no.
You don't want to mess with Daredevil. You don't want to mess with Hawkeye. Red She-Hulk has been going 40 issues or something like that.
Oh, more. I think it's up to 60.
Yeah, but they just said, this is your starting point. This is the new story, you know? And it's like, and that's a perfect jumping on point. You just go, all right, I'll go
for it. But we're getting some great new titles out of this as well. Like the stuff that Dave and I were talking about this before the show. The stuff that Jason Aaron is doing on Thor. Amazing.
Ah, fantastic. You know?
And so, Matt Fraction.
Matt Fraction is just firing all cylinders at the moment. So, you know, I don't know what DC's doing here. There was a few things. There was a... There's talk that, because of the way the DC editorial structure, everything seems to go through Didio. And it's like he's kind of like the only editorial voice from what we're hearing, which is a problem.
Phantom Stranger will go on for 100
years. Yeah, exactly.
You know what? Even if they wanted to cancel Phantom Stranger, they can't. Because they're committed to doing the Trinity thing.
Oh, no, and Didio's writing.
Didio's writing it.
But the point is, because they're committed to this Trinity thing, because they committed to this 17 months ago, they can't ever cancel him, not until at least they get to that, because they need him for that, you know? Yeah. So it's like, even if the book sucks...
There's been a lot of talk about what's going on at DC. Creators aren't happy. Mm. You know, it's still a situation where you are getting some interesting stuff like Lemire doing Arrow, but how many issues in? It took them 17 issues to replace, frankly, what should have been a tentpole book for them, because they would have known they were coming into a Green Arrow TV series. What should have... And to replace what was, frankly, one of the worst books... I have read ever, like the Anne Nocenti stuff, and she's just actually started a new book. Help me out here with the title. The new book that's started out this week, the Katana.
Yes,
sorry,
Katana.
And we're talking about that before.
Yeah, and it's actually quite good. So she's not a bad writer, but just completely directionless on Arrow. So DC editorial needs some work. Look, I'm not going to judge this before we go into it.
I think this is so interesting as well, though, because 17 months ago, we were so on board with what they did. You know what I mean? We sat there going, this is a really interesting
Our first issue was just singing its praises.
Absolutely. It was like, what an interesting thing to do. This is so bold. It's, you know, it's fascinating.
That was the reason why you guys started this show.
Well, it was one of the starting points, was we kind of went, okay, let's jump on at this point and have a look. And we were actually, in for the first few, we talked about New 52 nonstop for the first, but it was so interesting because as the first few months went by, it was like the New 52, and you were literally reading everything in the New 52, and then it was, oh, we're only reading about 40 books now, and then we're only reading about 20.
Now
it's
like, we're like
it just
kind of
siphoned it down to like, okay, you know what? This maybe not have been such a good move after all.
And then every month, someone's leaving or someone's fired. Rob Liefeld was on Twitter. Like, you know,
And we were talking about this just before the show. What does DC do with characters who fail? They just move them into other books. Mr. Terrific, which is by far and about one of the worst books that they came out with in that whole beginning. So they finally got rid of that book, thank God. What's happened? They've rolled him into Earth 2 now. And it's like he's now, okay, he's
back.
But
he couldn't carry his own book. So at least he's kind of like, for some reason, he's got a fan base that they're appealing to.
Maybe someone in DC corporate.
Editorial.
Maybe, maybe they just love it or something.
Somebody
there's
likes
a terrific TV series in the works.
But there's some really bizarre stuff that's going on behind the scenes. There has to be.
Like the choices they've made. Yeah. It's just...
Like, what about the story of, like, Gail Simone? She's fired from Batgirl, and then a week later, they're like, oh, no, she's rehired.
Little choices. I mean, things like, simple things, like, why would they do to Huntress what they've done to Huntress when they've got a Birds of Prey book?
Yeah.
They could have brought Huntress into Birds of Prey.
And Birds of Prey still seems to be more or less in continuity.
It's kind of in continuity, and it would benefit from having Huntress in that book. Power Girl has been completely... obliterated. I mean, that is not Power Girl. I don't know what that is. And so instead, they create this book that is lightweight, weird. It's vaguely childlike. World's Finest is not. It's doing neither of those characters justice.
No, it's one of those things where you forget about it.
As soon as you eat it, you're hungry for another one. You know what I mean?
And let's be honest here. How many of these New 52 titles do you guys remember the next month?
Very few.
Here's a good indicator for you. You get the New 52 titles. I load them up on the iPad. I literally will chew through 10 of them.
Yep.
In the space it would take me to read three or four Marvel books, because you just go, yep, just turning pages. You know what I mean?
And it's like, with the exception of the Bat books and a few other exceptions, you kind of like, What non-book bat books out this week that are worth reading? Not many.
Not many.
I mean, there's a reason DC got 13 bat books. Now, quickly moving on to the news. If you're excited about new comics, Viz are bringing out a Hello Kitty comic. Now, the reason I mention this...
At this point, we go, no!
You know what? I'm going to stand by this because I reckon this is going to sell a shitload of books. And I just wanted to include Hello Kitty because I like Hello Kitty.
They put out a My Little Pony comic.
My Little Pony sold through the roof.
New TV series has got this huge fan base. But it's the
Lauren Faust fan base. Because Lauren Faust did Powerpuff Girls and she did Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends.
Yeah.
And then she did My Little Pony.
And the whole Brony movie.
Friendship is magic. This is actually the reason I put this story in here was not just because I like Hello Kitty, but because this movement in comics is actually gaining some momentum. That whole secondary market. Now, this is a market that are people who are just into cutesy stuff, people who are younger audiences
I just can't stand.
Because let's not forget, like all the stuff we're talking about, New 52, Marvel Now, kids still have to start reading comics again. This is all being aimed at us. You know, people in our 30s and 40s who want to read the stories of our favorite characters that we've been reading for decades.
Yeah.
You know, kids have to get into comics. Now, if Hello Kitty is a gateway drug, you know, I'm all for it. And if they tell good stories, it looks like they're doing some clever stuff. They're doing like European style trade paperback things as their introduction. So it's actually waiting. I actually stood in a comic shop here in Sydney, and a kid went up to the counter holding. His gateway drug. No, he was holding the first volume of the Justice League New 52, and he was asking, what books can I get that have all the DC characters in them? You know, and that's the way a kid thinks. They want to read all their favorite characters, a team-up. That's why all those books like, you know, the Justice League kids version of them and all those team-up books and Brave and the Bold.
What's
and all
a Superman adventure? Superman family adventures.
That's why they're so appealing to kids, because they're just their favorite characters doing stuff. They don't care about the arcs and continuities and who's writing it and whatever. Yeah. That's what they want to read. So that's why I'll always follow news like this, because it's like, you know how big Archie comics have gotten the last couple of years, and they've really built up. This could be, you know, look, Sanrio being a massive company. It's not just Hello Kitty that's entering comics. It's Sanrio's entire line potentially that could be in comics. And that could be bigger
I guess it's just not for me. That's the problem.
But from that end to something where we get to kick a bit of ass, Batman, a new Batman Arkham game could be with us as early as the end of this year.
Boy, they're really churning them out now, aren't
they? Yeah, well, this actually let slip in a Time Warner management discussion. It was like they're discussing their fourth quarter. And in his speech, the guy just said, and we also have a strong games release year, which will include the next release in the Batman Arkham franchise. So all in all, we expect to post another very strong year in 2013. That was just a throwaway line, but it's just sent the net into frenzy going, we didn't even know this thing was coming.
Yeah.
And so whether it's going to be bigger, because like we went from Arkham Asylum to
Arkham City Arkham World.
You know, are we going to, you know, are we going to actually...
Crisis.
Arkham Nation.
Well, I really want to see the next game where we get to just run around Gotham. Mm. Like Gotham. Yeah.
They should do like a Grand Theft Auto kind of thing with it.
Yes. I want to see a total... Yeah.
Like you can drive up to the, you know...
Completely open world.
The whole of the Justice.
Yeah. And- no, I want to. I want to see the Saints Row version of it.
Yeah.
To run around with a giant dildo and beat people.
The Black Manta, as you
run around with a giant Black Manta and beat people. That I'm going to move swiftly into a bit of this.
We are pushing our clean tag a little bit here.
Yeah, look, we did last week. We did the pro as well. Look, movie news, big movie news this week. It's all about Guardians again. Of course, it's all going to be about the Guardians casting because it's the big great unknown at the moment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But Chris Pratt has, who you'll probably know from Parks and Recreation.
He was in Moneyball as well.
Yeah. And I think he's got the sensibilities. He's been cast as Peter Quill.
I'm not totally against this choice.
And you look at him, you kind of say, yeah, I can see that, and he's kind of got the comic chops to pull off.
I would have preferred Levi, but Zachary Levi,
yeah, that would have been good.
Chris Pratt's okay.
But I think I like the fact that they're going with someone slightly unknown. Mm. Not unknown, but he's a TV actor.
Well, that's kind of one of the problems of it. I'm a huge fan of Parks and Recreation, the show. But, like, you know, telling this news to other people, you're like, it's starring Chris Pratt. And they're like, who?
Who,
And they're like, in the Guardians of the Galaxy. They're like,
and they go, what?
Which is and they go, he's from Parks and Recreation. They go,
Yeah, what? But the bigger issue is you say Guardians of the Galaxy and they say what? Yeah. Nobody knows.
But everyone's going to know, I think.
We're borderline John Carter territory here, which is where it was a good movie. Had a good lead, but no one had heard of the lead or the franchise, and people ignored it because everyone told them to. Mm-hmm. I'm really hoping Guardians is in that, but hopefully they'll set up Guardians so heavily in the other Marvel movies that
I have no doubt that Marvel will make it a household name before it comes out.
The other bit of casting which has been mentioned is Jason Momoa has been testing for the role of Drax the Destroyer. Which is something I can actually see.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. We should be very clear and say that nothing has been confirmed on that at all.
No, but in fact, Boris Kitt, who is from Hollywood Reporter, actually tweeted later that day to say, look, just to clarify, this is a test, not an offer of a role. But I think a lot of people are very excited about this offer because,
and as much as I hated the remake of Conan, he was good in Game of Thrones. So I have no problems with Momoa as such, and playing the big brooding Drax is perfect for him. Drax doesn't really issue out really intelligible conversations.
No, he's not. He doesn't have to do much except, you know, look good.
Yeah,
on
be
screen.
A big green barbarian warrior.
But speaking of Game of Thrones, Peter Dinklage has joined the cast of X-Men Days of Future Past.
I'm very curious about this casting. I love Peter Dinklage.
So apparently he's been cast as the major antagonist. This news comes straight from Bryan Singer, who actually tweeted, pleased to announce that Game of Thrones as Peter Dinklage has joined the cast of X-Men Days of Future Past. Major antagonist. You've just read Days of Future Past recently.
Well, a few months.
Yeah, so
but I still can't see who'd play.
Yeah, look, there's been a bit of stuff kicking around the net about this at the moment. Keep talking while I look this up. Yeah,
no, so I'm fascinated because I've got to say my reading of Days of Future Past was a very long time ago. Yes, it's one of the ones I'm going to go back and reread it soon, actually. And I'm trying to think. I don't remember any character that he would play.
The issue with it, I guess, is like, you know, I don't know how politically correct I am in saying this, but, you know, he's of short stature. Mm. And you know, like,
that's a very great way of putting it.
A lot of people, when he was first cast, assumed he'd be like someone like Puck from Alpha Flight or something like that.
Well, that would make sense.
But apparently they're looking at maybe him being the, I think it's Bolivar Trask, who's the creator of the Sentinels. Allegedly, he's been cast.
And it wouldn't matter what his height was. Yeah. I mean,
which is, you know, makes it, they could play with that whole dynamic of, like, he's a small man.
Making huge robots.
You know, that would be a really interesting dynamic on screen as well. So, look, you know, doesn't matter. Peter Dinklage is an awesome actor.
That's it, exactly.
And they've cast him in what is set to be one of the biggest fan fests, which is not only a sequel, it's not only going to be X-Men 4, but First Class 2. Anybody who's, like, they've confirmed that all sorts of people are coming back. Ellen Page is coming back as Kitty Pryde, and she was barely, you know,
noticeable. But she was a great Kitty Pryde, though. I mean, that's the thing. For her five minutes of screen time, she was perfect as Kitty Pryde.
And they're even bringing her back. So, like, they've really tried their hardest to get everybody back for this. I'm cautiously excited.
It is, in a way, resetting the X-Men movies because they had become so fragmented with First Class and other things, and then the Wolverine spinoff, and it's so fragmented. You're going, what the hell are we doing here?
I was almost done with it.
But it's almost Fox saying, you know what? While Marvel, everyone's impressed what Disney and Marvel and Paramount have been doing, we've actually been building a universe here as well, and this is how we're going to tie ours together. This is their Avengers.
Interesting to see if they can make it work, because Fox does not have a history of being able to pull it together. That's the problem.
No. Now, just moving quickly through this, we mentioned that Arrow has been renewed for a second season. We mentioned that The Walking Dead mid-season returned to over 12 million viewers. And production has wrapped on the other big superhero TV show that's set to debut in fall 2013, which is S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. has wrapped. We have a pilot, which we assume will be picked up for about a dozen episodes or so.
I think it's got a pretty good chance. I think Disney is bankrolling this thing no matter what happens.
Yeah, I suspect.
So far, they've done everything right.
Because it's ABC, isn't it?
It's ABC. It's their network. They own it. So,
it's their network, so they're committed to this.
Yeah. Now, David, we've got a bit of feedback, so can we pipe in a little bit of this? Thank you, David, for that. So we've got a bit of feedback this week from Paul Gross, who is a long-time listener, first-time caller. Paul says, David McVeigh is Hank Scorpio. The voice is spot on. Hank, I felt I should be asking for directions to the Hammock District. Every time I hear the podcast, I keep looking for the nearest flamethrower. Keep up the good work, guys. Richard, you could be Mr. Bont. You have the Sean Connery down to a T. Please do a tribute, guys. The Simpsons fans would love it. So, at the request of a reader, and because we have a guest in here this week, Dave, you're going to be playing the part of Homer Simpson, while I'll be playing Mr. Bont, and David will be playing Hank Scorpio from the episode You Only Move Twice.
So, the listener just wants me to read it as me.
As you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So hold on a second.
Should we read as us?
You're as Homer and I'm as Mr. Bond.
Homer's a hard impression.
Just you've do only it got yourself. One line, okay,
yeah. I've only got one word, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, Homer, what's your least favorite country, Italy or France?
France.
Dope! Nobody ever says Italy.
Scorpio has a James Bond-style secret agent strapped to a table with a cutting laser edging up towards him.
Ingenious, isn't it, Mr. Bond?
Scorpio, you're totally mad.
Ha! I wouldn't point fingers, you jerk.
Sure expect me to talk?
I don't expect anything from you except to die and be a very cheap funeral. You're going to die now.
And scene.
Bravo, bravo.
So... is that what you want?
There you go, Paul. We hope you've brought a little bit of light into your day as we all enjoy this episode of Behind the Panels Masterclass Theatre. If anybody else has requests of things they'd like us to read out...
all I can say is, no!
You're totally mad, Scorpio. Thanks for that, Paul. That was a bit of fun. Now we're going to move on. It's that time again. David, I think without any further ado, we're now an hour and 5 minutes into the show. We should do a bit of this.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
Not a word I would equate with this book.
No, like every now and then our intro doesn't quite fit with the thing. I think when we were doing Mouse and Pedro and me, it wasn't the greatest choice of intro themes. We should have like the equivalent of
we need to have two.
The sad Hulk music. We should have that version of the intro theme. It's like,
we should have one that fits both. It's in the middle.
That's true.
That's awfully.
That's awfully not funny.
We're an hour and five, so Underwater World are pretty good. Yep.
So thanks for stopping by, Dave.
We should start this book club segment with the knowledge that Dave Longo over here is the biggest Jeff Lemire fan in the world.
Almost.
Almost.
Almost. Who is the biggest Jeff Lemire fan in the world?
It's probably my friend. His name's Jeff as well.
Right.
Jeff introduced me to Jeff Lemire. Lemire.
Lemire.
It's Lemire.
Lemire. It is Lemire. We have confirmation on
that.
That's
the problem. I've been saying Lemire for years.
I know. It's
now.
Hard to break.
It's hard to break
it.
Yeah. But he gave me a copy of Sweet Tooth, the first volume,
yep,
a couple of years ago. Love Sweet Tooth. Had a bit of an issue with the ending of it, but, you know, whatever. Yeah, but basically, like, there's the first thing to say about Jeff Lemire is that he has this artistic style that you either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
And personally, I think all of us, actually, we just love it.
Yeah,
he's love, just yes, absolutely work. Stunning artist. Yeah. And because of that, his focus is on the artwork.
Yeah.
And so his dialogue is very minimal and, you know, it's great and everything like that. But the first thing to say is that Jeff Lemire is a... sorry, I'm going to do this the whole time.
Let's call him Jeff from now
on. Let's just call him Jeff.
Now, we actually talked to Jeff.
How did you guys not say it to him?
I think saying his name didn't come up a lot.
No, and funnily enough, because I am not as exposed to Jeff Lemire as the two of you, for me it's very natural just to say Jeff Lemire.
Yeah.
Because I don't have... It's like, I have more problems with Kevin Feige,
Hey.
You know? Because we really still don't... I mean, he's mentioned it, but, you know, whatever. But you know...
I'm sure he has a name.
I'm sure he has a name. But one never really bothered me.
That's the first thing to say about it. The artwork is incredible.
Yeah,
and,
phenomenal.
You know, if you don't like his artwork, don't pick this up. Hmm. The second thing to say about the book is that Jeff Lemire... I'm gonna do it the whole show.
Why don't you say Jeff?
I'll just say Jeff. The thing about Jeff is that when he's relatively young for a comic book creator.
He's very young, yeah.
And you know, like 5-6 years ago when Essex County came out, he was extremely young. And that and have you guys read Essex County?
I've read Essex County.
He's read the whole thing. I've read about half.
That's
of
an absolutely incredible book. And the thing is,
I cried at least twice reading.
So did I. And that's the thing. It's like that. Jeff, as a writer artist, his work is so up high at such a young age. So yeah, everything that follows, you kind of have to grade.
He's 36 now.
It's incredible.
And he's been in the industry for at least a decade. So, you know, he's been at the top of his game for a long time.
And when you talk to him, he's got that, he comes across as that young voice, you know, and that actually is good for him as
What struck me is he was talking about how he reads a lot of prose as well and what have you, but he is a true comic book creator in the sense that his medium, he's a writer-artist and his medium is comics. And he thinks in terms of sequential art.
We even asked him whether he was interested in moving into film or anything. He said, no, his love is comics.
He was actually a... I wouldn't use the word failed, but that's a word that he used in an interview. Failed filmmaker.
Right.
Is that he actually studied film school in his early careers, if I'm not wrong.
No, he did.
Interestingly enough, so did Bendis. Bendis was a failed screenwriter.
Yeah.
That word. Not failed, but I mean, he started as that. He moved to comics to fill the time.
Well, according to his bio, that he realized that filmmaking didn't suit his solitary personality.
There you go.
And I think that's a really interesting thing because a lot of his books reflect that kind of solitary nature and loneliness and trying to connect to the world. And certainly
particularly
Essex County.
This
book definitely, but Essex County had it as well. And The Nobody did as well, which is another one of his books about a man who walks into a town and he's just covered in bandages and we don't know why.
I haven't read this.
So yeah, no, that's another one worth reading, and I think we should do all of Lemire's books at some stage. On this,
I just managed to get my hands on his run of Superboy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's a 12-issue run on Superboy.
So
wasn't it?
I just managed to get my hands on that, so I'm gonna have a look at that as well. He's a fascinating writer.
It's worth saying, I guess, that his superhero stuff is not bad either.
No,
it's very different though. His Superman stuff is a little bit more verbose. It's a little bit more. So he adapts to.
He's writing other people's characters
exactly,
and this is purely him.
Yeah.
This is his mind. And
there's literally not another hand on it.
I think it's
even lettered by him.
The book just says The Underwater Welder, Jeff Lemire, and I think no truer words have been spoken on the title page of a book.
To talk about Longo over here, Dave.
Yep,
I just talk about Dave's conversation at the very beginning of this when he was talking about the artwork. We're saying that how he is so in tune with the comic book media that he can tell a story with panels. If you look at Underwater Welder. Yeah.
I got a bit sidetracked there. That's what I was
A word isn't spoken until the sixth page.
Because he understands visuals so well that he communicates it all there. He doesn't need... why the dialogue is sparse.
You look at something like Essex County. It's a 500-page tome and it's a complete thing. And you read it
in a couple hours
because it's mostly visual.
Yeah.
And it's just... It's like watching a 2-hour movie. You know, it's so well conveyed.
It's a 2-hour art movie.
Some use of the panels in here that are absolutely amazing. Like, it starts really small and then gets bigger and bigger, and then all of a sudden you've got huge splash pages that just absolutely just...
Yeah, and I'm looking at something like page 95 in here, where you've got kind of like three panels. It's split into 12 panels. The three panels along the top is some dialogue, and the rest of the other nine panels on the page form one scene. But the way he split it up is a very deliberate choice to make you to pace the way that you read that.
Absolutely.
So let's go back to the start of before we get too far ahead.
Mm-hmm. Let's summarize the book.
Right. Dave, can you give us a brief summary of what
it's
about?
Yeah. Okay. Well, basically, it's about a middle-aged man named Jack. He's married to a Susie, I think her name is. Mm-hmm. The wife.
I think so.
Yeah, and for his occupation, he works as an underwater welder in a...
It's an oil rig, isn't it?
An oil rig in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but at the same time, his wife is 9 months pregnant, and he's undergoing quite a lot of parental anxiety issues, let's say. And so it's this wonderful story about a man who's trying to cope with sorting out his own past issues with his own father.
Well, he has abandonment issues. There's a lot of baggage behind this guy.
And what's great about it is at the same time he's got a child on the way.
Yeah.
And so it's I have to deal with my past to deal with my future. And then I'm going to just pass on to one of you guys to get into the Twilight Zone kind of...
Yeah, well, we mentioned this when we were interviewing him as well. We mentioned last week that in the introduction to this book, Damon Lindelof, who wrote Prometheus, amongst other things.
We're just talking about a quote.
just quickly on that, Damon, if you go back and look at everything that Lemire has written, Lindelof has an introduction for it.
They're obviously
like
friends.
Total buddies.
Yeah. Now, of course, he's also known for writing Lost as well, things like that. Yeah, no, it's and he writes this is the best episode of Twilight Zone that was never made.
What is the best episode of Twilight Zone never produced?
And in many ways, that's true. But I think where it works more is as a personal story about depression.
Yeah.
David was saying this to me before the show, that it's about depression. It's about solitude. I mean, we mentioned the fact that Lemire himself writes comic books because he likes the solitary nature of it. This is someone else who's chosen a job. His main character has chosen a job that's deliberately solitary.
Mm. I think if you boil this book down, he basically goes back to the rig to do this thing. He goes under, he has the vision, and then we go into this solitary fantasy, basically, of him showing back up the town. Everybody's gone. He's left alone. But I think the literal interpretation is he goes down, he probably gets the bends or something like that. Mm-hmm. Who knows what happens? All of that's in his fever dream, and then he's woken when they find him. This has all been his mind working out
absolutely
what he's going through.
And I think that's one of the kind of the weird things about having an introduction that you know, sets it up as the Twilight Zone, you know, like, because I think the aspect is fun in the book,
but it actually does work though, because it actually intrigued me. Okay. So as soon as I read that, I went, okay, I'm curious to see where we're going to go
Do you see that automatically puts an expectation?
Look, I think the best Twilight Zone episodes are ones where the mundane seemed quite extraordinary before you realize it is actually quite mundane again. And this is far from mundane because, you know, anyone who's like myself has had to deal with things like depression or anxiety knows that it is a massive thing. It is your entire world.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Because it is like being underwater.
It's like it's parental anxiety on the surface level. On the surface level, it's parental anxiety. But below that, it's anxiety, depression, and things in general. That's why I think it's... I don't have children. Mm. You know, but for me, I relate entirely.
I think we can all... Because Lemire's stories are so personal, it doesn't matter where he's writing them. Even Animal Man, which he's recently... That's a father-son relationship in that as well. But you can totally relate to that because of the way that he's written these as personal stories. In Essex County, it's a saga of... It's another father-son relationship there all throughout that. You know, he writes these stories so well.
Sweet Tooth,
definitely. Even Arrow, they're talking about there's lingering issues there with Oliver Queen's relationship to his father and how that's going to come back to haunt him, you know. So it's obviously a recurring motif throughout his work, but the central things, as you say, of depression and anxiety are something that unfortunately we can all relate to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes this book so powerful for me, and I dare say for the rest of us as well, is that it's a
even something as simple as it's the watch, the time,
exactly. Yeah. And it is such a powerful thing throughout. But as David was saying, that it's that Twilight Journey element that draws you in that little bit for dramatic purposes.
Because let's face it, when you first pick this book up and open it up and you see these six pages of no dialogue, you're going, what the hell? By having that little bit at the beginning, you're going, this is going to build to something. And so it suddenly puts your attention, it puts you on edge.
It does,
and it puts you on edge. You sit there going, what's going to happen? Something is going to happen somewhere in this book that is out there. And so you immediately become very, very attuned or very, very... aware of every panel, every page, wondering where it's going to happen. And I think that really focuses you into the book. It focused me. And it focused me to the point where I'm going, I really want to know what's happening. And then once you get about 10 pages, 15, 20 pages into the book, it's already got a life of its own. After that, you don't need to be drawn in because you've been so focused into it, you're there.
I guess it's something that should have maybe been more on the cover than...
Well, I don't know. I think the cover is so... looking at the cover, beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of artwork on the cover. And you look at that and you go, that's intriguing enough to pick up and look inside. Then you read that intro and you go, now I'm intrigued. I want to read it. You know? So I think they did. I think it's strategically, I think it's very well placed.
And I think what's intriguing to me about Lemire as a writer is that this came out late last year. This is in the middle of his Animal Man stuff. This is obviously he'd started writing Arrow by this stage and all have you, that he can go off and do superhero books and still come back and write something.
Well, think about it. It's probably a release for him.
It is a release for him. And I think it's just such a rare treat in the comics world where everything is so focused on DC Marvel to have a writer that is just so... can write such personal things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we spoke about this a bit in our interview as well about maybe the perception of graphic novels changing over decades as well. And it's books like this. I mean, you can speak of this book in the same breath as I liked it, and I don't know, I hope I'm not overstating it, but in the same breath as books like Mouse, as books like Pedro and Me.
I can see that. Yeah.
Because they are such personal narratives in there. Now, while Underwater Welder is certainly not as autobiographical as those two books I mentioned, it is that person. This is one of those books that I think will probably end up standing up in those, you know, essential graphic novels that you have to read, you know, when they
republish 100 graphic novels you must read before you die.
Of things that come out. There's all the obvious ones, and increasingly those lists are dominated by these indie guys. They're not the Capes book. There's a handful of great Capes stories.
I think it's very interesting that a lot of the great Capes writers are capable of going off and knocking these sort of things off, basically as a sideline. It's like you look at Diggle, and you look at the fact that...
Or is it the other way around? Is the Capes stuff paying the bills so they can
That's
go
it,
off
yeah.
and
it's
do it?
Well, it's a bit of both.
One for me, one for them.
Yeah, because, I mean, you look, Diggle just did Ratcatcher just recently. Yeah. Now he's got Snapshot that's coming out, which is
just
issue
read
one.
The first issue of Snapshot. It's quite good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've got it. I haven't read it yet. But at the same time as doing that, he's knocking out Superman now.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like you sit there and go, okay, so Diggle's gone on to do... And he's a great writer. And so, and I think it keeps him fresh as well. And I think this is the one thing that we were talking about before, Grant Morrison. I don't think Grant Morrison was finding that balance. Mm. I think he's much more focused on his independent stuff, and his Cape stuff is suffering.
Yeah.
And so when we see them find this balance where... I mean, Bendis does the same thing. Bendis will go off and write crime books and stuff like that, or powers or what have you, while he's doing all of this really big commercial stuff. Mm. And you sit there and go, good for you. You need that independent stuff to keep you fresh. You know?
I think Lemire said it really good in the interview you guys did with him, where he was saying, you know, that one of the great things about creator-owned work is that, you know, you can have an ending. You know, you don't have to, you know, this has to happen at the end of this issue, and then, you know, 12 issues later I have to do something else again. And you're kind of sandboxed a bit.
Yeah.
And then you have something like this. Like, you can compare this really easily to, like, Animal Man, you know, or even Arrow, right? Like, you know, that in here, he's it's pure expression.
Yeah.
But no way in hell is DC going to let him draw their titles.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine something like this in DC.
They'd probably put it out.
It would be amazing.
They'd put it out under DC Vertigo at best. This one's out through Top Shelf Productions, and I think a few
I have seen it before, though. You know, in the Legends of the Dark Knight, he had a one-shot.
Yeah.
You know, but it was very small.
But he's... you get backup stuff like that. I think... Although I was really encouraged to see what they did with Andrea Sorrentino's art with Green Arrow 17.
It's very, very stylized.
It's very stylized. And I think, you know, in many ways, it's kind of like come full circle. I think they were influenced just as much by what Hawkeye's doing with their very stylized version of the gritty urban sort of thing. I think mainstream comics are slowly, because all these guys now are getting the top gigs, they're saying, well, no, don't hire us and then make us do your thing. Mm. You're hiring us because you want our work.
Hmm.
And so if you're going to hire someone like Lemire, and Sorrentino did American Vampire,
some back issues.
And he's got that very distinct artwork as well. He's got this very artwork that looks great in black and white. So what did they do with the first issue? He colored it himself and left half the panels in black and white,
yes.
Which looked amazing.
Yeah.
You know? There's actually a black and white cover variant of that.
I love the fact that he'll do panels within panels. So you'll have a color panel, but then you'll have a black and white panel within the color panel. It's fantastic.
Bringing up an interesting question in my mind to ask you guys. Do you make a distinction between creator-owned comics and DC comics when you're looking at them like critically?
Look,
like, would you be like, will you judge it on the same story kind of basis?
In terms of reviewing, and I think we do with all books, sorry if I'm speaking for both of us here, which is I think we look at story first. Did we enjoy the story? Did the story engage us? Yes, no. And then we try and place it in context. I think, you know, it's like when we went back and did all the those stories from the 70s. It's like, okay, well, the story maybe didn't engage us as much as it does.
But you have to put it in time and place.
It's like, you know, this would have been as a monthly book back when it was released. Yeah. You have to remember when we're reading big arcs. And I think this the distinction here is that this was written as a single story to be read in a single, if not a single sitting, to be read in a single as a single entity, as opposed to his work on Green Arrow, his work as Animal Man, which stretched out over the course of a couple of years. I think that's an important distinction. I think I think it is a good distinction to make. I think it is one worth
making.
It's
not so much a distinction between whether it's one of the top two companies or an independent, or whether it is a monthly standalone. I think that's the issue.
Well, I think it's also, as Dave was saying, the creator-owned aspect of it, because you're going to get a lot more creative freedom when you get something like this, and you can judge this as the absolute expression of someone's inner thoughts, as opposed to the compromises that one has to make.
Although
I would
also
DC.
Point out, though, that you will have under the label of DC something like Dark Knight Returns or The Watchmen. Mm. So
yeah, they're anomalies, though. You don't get.
Well, I guess how far you go, right? Because you could be like Vertigo is.
Well, the thing is, they've all got like all the majors have got imprints now. Yeah, and most of that stuff.
Well, Marvel's got Icon, which is doing Powers. So
and DC Vertigo, and I think
Marvel's also got Max is back.
So they can, but that's really more mainstream, but with more violence in a lot of ways. But they have been doing some interesting stuff, like the artwork on the Wolverine Max stuff is quite interesting as well.
As I say, I think for me personally, the distinction.
But the game is changing. I mean, you're looking at DC have got a third of the market, Marvel have got a third of the market, and everybody else
has a third of the market. Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean to say that I mean, like, you're not looking at Image being a third major company yet, but Image are doing such amazing stuff the last couple of years, and they're all largely, you know, creator-owned kind of concepts coming out there with real bold visions. They've got to be looking to those guys and saying, we're losing ground here. Yeah. What can we learn from these guys?
But I think the original question that you were throwing down, Dave, was...
Sorry to sidetrack.
No, this is good stuff. The question you threw down was, do we differentiate between the independent stuff and the big two? Do we review differently, basically? Do we hold them to different standards? I don't. I look at them and go, it's the story, the read. What I do, the only thing that I think we'd look at is... The two factors for me would be whether it is a standalone work like this or an ongoing series, and B, time and place.
Yeah.
So I think you contextually have to put it into place. So you have to look at it and go, the pro that we did last week, we look at that and go, that's not funny, it's not original, it's not particularly good. But if you put that into time and place and say in 1992, when that came out, that would have been considered incredibly subversive. And so in 1992, it may have had much more impact because we've seen so many subversive comics now that we go, it's a mild, you know,
diversion.
You've
got to be contextual about it.
So, yeah. And like, we look at Green Arrow, Green Lantern. By today's standards, we look at that and go, it's a bit preachy, it's a bit repetitive, it's a bit this. But in 1970, whatever it was when it came out, that was hard-hitting, cutting-edge stuff. That had a real statement to say.
The only thing I would add to that is I agree with everything you've said, except that I think with creator-owned stuff, you also have to give extra couple of marks, if we were giving marks, and give props to the fact that it's so much harder to get that stuff done. I mean, this is... For someone to publish this, like someone's put money in to publish a run of this book, it's a risky prospect.
You're releasing a book called Underwater Welder.
Yeah. In black and white. Yeah.
And you sit there and go, it doesn't exactly have sex appeal.
Did you guys hear this? This was 4 years in the making?
I can imagine. Well, no, yeah. I didn't realize that. I can imagine it would have been.
Yeah. So, but as a shelf item, it doesn't exactly have sex appeal. No. You know what I mean? So somebody took a top shelf, took a massive roll of the dice and said, we trust Jeff.
I wouldn't be surprised if this ends up as a film pretty soon.
I actually said I think it should be an animation. It should be an animated feature film.
If they did an animation in his style.
Yeah. I think it would be amazing.
They wouldn't have to change anything.
With really rough hewn animation, and it would just be fantastic.
That's the thing. I mean, converting films... I mean, comics and film are very different mediums, and a book like this, like The Underwater Welder, is proof that sequential art has its own way of telling a story, deliberately paces you as much as a film does, because a film, you are locked into that pacing for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it is. That is the pacing of the film. A book you can read at your you can sometimes read a bit faster, but if the language is written such a way to deliberately slow you down, you think someone like Cormac McCarthy writes in a way that you deliberately have to read
this at reminds me of something Alan Moore would say. Like, you know, you could read Moby Dick in a few hours if you wanted to, but you're
missing
the point.
Yeah.
Whereas that's the thing with a comic, you can, you know, have your own pacing.
And the other thing about a comic, though, is that it's so easy to reread. So, like, you sit down and you read a book, it's a real investment to put down prose, as we would say.
Yeah.
There's a real investment into that prose. You can read through a comic book really fast, and then go back and peruse it really slowly. Mm. And you're going to get just as much out of it the second time round because you're now focusing on the art. You're now focusing on the this.
Like, we've all read Watchmen several times.
Absolutely.
And there's something new I discover every time.
Rereading Dark Knight Returns.
Exactly.
For watching it on this show, for doing it on this show. And you're discovering all this stuff. You sit there and go, I don't even remember this the first time around.
Sorry, Richard, what were you going to say before? I felt like I interrupted you.
No. I pretty much got my point out there. But it was just the idea. I mean, look, I think just to touch on what we were talking about before, when we were saying that this book is a particularly good example of deliberately pacing because, as we said, that panel, page 95, I think I was talking about, where he's grabbed what is essentially a single image but broken down into the pacing he wants you to go at. So I think comics and films are very different mediums. Alan Moore, I think it could have been Alan Moore or Frank Miller, and I've mentioned this quote before, wanted to go back and said that Hollywood would turn to them for ideas rather than the other way around. And I would be a little disappointed to see this, I think this is what I was going to say before, I would be disappointed to see this adapted in a way because to me it's a perfect entity as it is.
Absolutely agree.
And there are cases where you're surprised. Dark Knight Returns is an animation completely.
Well, that's why I think this should be
completely knock move six. But I think
I only really mentioned that it would be a film just as sort of in the way that
cinematic.
It's so hard to get it out, and then when it's out, everyone.
But as I say, I think if you converted this to live action, it would lose
everything.
But the thing is,
the only great thing about a film live action otherwise coming out of this is that more people would read this, and that's the best thing that we can say about this book is that if the more people who read it, the better off your life's going to be.
Well, and that's kind of how I feel about Walking Dead. Look, it's misgiving we have about the series, whatever. The one thing that comes out of The Walking Dead is the fact that there are a lot of people who go, I want to go read The Walking Dead.
And they are. People are still coming and going, where can I get them? Get the collections,
exactly.
Get singles.
Which brings people to comic books. They read that. Then they go, oh, what else can I read? And we get more comic book readers. And that's the one thing. I mean, if you have nothing else, The Walking Dead and Arrow.
And Hello Kitty.
And Hello Kitty, give us comic book readers and keep our industry alive because this is an industry that we love.
Yes.
You know? There was a very, very dark time in comic books a decade ago where it looked like it was all folding up. You know, I mean, Marvel was at the point of almost claiming bankruptcy.
Well, actually, they
did. They filed Chapter 11 twice, I think.
I think so,
over the course of a decade period, 15 years ago or whatever it was, and now they're right on top again.
Is it true with the digital revolution that comics is as strong as it's ever been? Or?
Well, I think digital is probably doing for what comics that iTunes did for music.
Yeah.
It's giving people a different way of buying comics. You can buy a single issue for 99 cents.
And look, Comixology and digital comics have been around for a long time. Let's not sidestep here. The iPad really reinvigorated the whole concept of comics.
Well, I read something really interesting recently.
Suddenly it was an easy way to consume those digital comics that have been around for a while, but nobody wanted to sit in front of a computer screen to do this.
No. I mean, I read so much many more comics just by virtue of the fact that I can...
Tablets, not just necessarily iPad, but tablets.
I can take the entire week's releases with me.
Exactly, and that's exactly how I feel. I load it up, and it's easy to peruse. You can find out exactly what's new. You don't have to go and worry about pull lists. You don't have to go worry about going into comic book stores and actually having to wade through all the racks to find out what's new.
I don't mind wading through racks.
Put your Black Manta away. Now, so you can literally open up Comixology on your iPad, and there's all the titles for the month laid out in front of you in the feature page. And you go, oh, that's come out. And you sit there and go, and then we're not saying you're going to get everything there, but it's a great way of introducing people to it. And that will bring people to comic book shops. It'll bring people to wondering what's out in print. I think I think the digital revolution has saved this industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. I read this really interesting article. I can't remember for the life of me where it was, but it was suggesting that the iPad allows you to read comics in the closet.
Oh, I read in bed in the dark.
Yeah.
Because now I can get into bed. My wife is laying beside me. She's already wants to go to sleep. She doesn't want me to sitting there with the lights on. I can get into bed. I can turn my iPad on. I can read a couple of comic books before going to bed. Not disturbing anybody.
But it's like the Harry Potter books got republished with like adult covers.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Like 50 Shades of Grey.
Right. It's kind of like, you know, slipping a paper bag over your comic, but you can still read it. No, I've got my iPad. I could be doing anything, but no, I'm actually reading comics. I'm sitting on the bus and loving it.
Do you know what it's the equivalent of the kid sitting under the blanket with the flashlight.
No one knows I'm not doing my mouse homework.
Exactly.
I'm actually I'm reading Animal Man on the bus. You know, that's what I'm doing. And I think it's great. I think portability, because Look, print as a medium is going to slowly fade eventually. There'll always be a market for it. I think comics is particularly a medium where the collector market.
Let's face it, the printed comic book is still the king. The printed comic book. You look at this printed version of Underwater Welder.
Beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
And look, it's the sheer amount of variants that are still coming out every month. God, Scotty Young is just making a fortune. Must be on his variant covers with baby Avengers for, you know.
Just give him a book already. I mean, really, let's just give him a book, you know?
I mean, look, you know, still on Lemire. He did have that baby. No, he has got an ongoing book. He's doing the Wizard of Oz stuff with...
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, but I'm talking about they need to give him an A-Babies book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he did that one-off special, which was
A-Babies.
A monthly. Come on, let's go. No, I agree.
let's do it. Come on.
I don't think with all of his other cover art he could keep up the pace.
I think they should have an A-Babies versus JLL Babies.
Oh.
Crossover JLL, every month.
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
What was the last time they did a crossover?
Oh, God.
It wasn't that long ago. It was probably about a decade ago. There was
years ago.
Yeah, but it was a big event. Yeah. It was a George Perez thing, I think. I've completely lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Let's go back to Underwater Welder and basically say that this is on our list, the behind the panels list of essential reading, and it goes down on like Ratcatcher goes down as essential reading and a modern classic. In its first month of release. I mean, you know, it's like, we're not even looking at time on this one. I mean, Mouse, yes, essential reading. Dark Knight Returns, yes, essential reading. But these have been around for years.
Yeah.
This one is going straight onto that shelf. This is one that is, I think, is an important work. I think it is a great piece of art. And it's a fascinating insight into a man who basically is having trouble coping. And I think that it is just, I think anybody who is, particularly if you're going through something at the moment, it's a really good book to read because it kind of gives you hope at the end.
It's kind of cathartic.
And believe me when I say it certainly did that for me.
Yeah, so it shows you there is hope at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. Which
the best
I think
book
is
about underwater welders that you're
about the lost art of underwater
welding.
I've
read a lot of books about underwater welders.
It trains you how to weld at one point.
Yeah. It does. It's true. Actually. Yeah, yeah. So if you're thinking about a career in underwater welding,
there you go. And it also talks about getting your mix right, and you know, it's very good. I'm highly recommending this book. I think this is a book that everybody should go out and buy.
And look, you know, while we're on the topic of Lemire, I think, you know, we can also recommend highly, as we've already said, Essex County
and Sweet Tooth.
And Sweet Tooth. Go out and get both.
Just don't read the final issue.
Yeah, look, I mean, final issue, we talked about this, it's a bit of a...
It's unnecessary as well.
It's unnecessary. It's got that sort of Why the Last Man final issue. Have you read
Why?
Yeah. But they both kind of, you know, it's my spoilers, they both jump ahead a bit and then kind of take us away from the story we've been following a little while. So I think... and we asked him if you know, because you wanted us to ask him about whether or not that he finished up Sweet Tooth deliberately because of his commitments with all these other monthly titles. He said no. He finished it where he wanted to finish it. So, you know.
It's respectable. But, you know, the ending of Sweet Tooth wasn't horrible.
And I'm looking forward.
I think it's just completely unnecessary.
No, I agree with you. But I'm looking forward to his next monthly, which is going to be a limited one, which is Trillium, coming out later this year. Can't wait. Yeah. So looking forward to
looking forward to the next Arrow issue, actually.
Anything with his name on it, I will be reading at the moment. And I think it's a rare thing. It's been a while since we've had... a handful of great newish writers that we just want to read everything that they do. And I think that's why I read comics, to discover new names.
Let's just go around the table to finish this episode off because we're going really long today.
Nah.
To run this off, though, let's just talk about this. Top four writers or comic book creators in general. Right now. In your current mindset, if they release something, they are the must writers. Dave, start.
Okay, Scott Snyder first up. This is really
come
really
back
difficult.
To you.
Yeah,
I'd say Snyder as well.
Jeff
Lemire. Yeah. I definitely say. I'm really liking everything Matt Fraction's doing at the moment with Hawkeye and certainly with FF.
Yeah.
So I'd certainly follow him. I'm guessing a fourth one. What else do I like that's out there at the moment?
Nate Powell's pretty fantastic.
Nate Powell's, who's doing Daredevil again at the moment?
Mark Wade's another one that
I'd probably name.
Yeah. I think with me at the moment, it's probably Diggle, Bendis.
Oh, Diggle, of course. Yeah, Diggle, I would definitely.
I think Diggle, Bendis, Snyder, and it's probably a toss up between Fraction and Lemire.
Yeah. No, Deagle is definitely, I'd slide in there as well.
These are like my top at the moment. Yeah. You come with yours?
I'm just going to go with.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't. Yeah, I never try and do
if
that.
If anybody out there really thinks difficult. That we there is an artist, creator, comic book, independent, mainstream, whatever.
I think Brian K. Vaughan is someone.
Artists as well. I follow artists. I follow anything that Michael Red puts out.
It's like I'll look at anything that Connor draws. And the problem is that sometimes it's not great, but I don't know. For some reason, Connor just attracts me.
Yeah.
I think it's a Usual Suspects kind of thing, isn't it?
It is. Look, I think these guys are the top of the game for...
It's like they are there for a reason.
Yeah.
I'm loving the artist of Justice League at the moment. I'm loving the way that he's creating these characters.
Yeah.
I'm not enjoying the writing as much as the art. That's the only problem.
I mean, Geoff Johns is going to get back to focusing on that.
Yeah, hopefully he will, because it started so strong and it's flailing the last few issues. So
well,
but the artwork is beautiful.
Perhaps if we can get Geoff on here, he can have a chat.
Geoff, we'd like to have a chat with you about this. We've got some words for you. No.
But look, that's... almost the end of the show, I think. Well, it is the end of the show.
Cut a flat line.
It's almost the end because we've still got to wrap up and say, Dave, thank you for coming.
No, thank you.
This has been Dave Longo from DamnGoodCup.com. I'm sure we'll have you on again.
I hope so.
Some stage in the future.
I had a lot of fun this time.
Look, you know.
Last time,
It's great. It's great to hear somebody other than David's voice.
Even though his name is Dave.
Yeah, exactly. It's great to have another David in the room.
I'll come back. I'll come back
with Stephen. Look, you know, next week we will be doing the new Deadwardians, which is a DC Vertigo title. It was a limited series.
It actually launched the same month as the New 52, if I remember it.
Around that. It didn't run quite as long. It ran about 8 issues, I think.
No, I'm saying it launched the same month. It was like...
Right.
It was the Vertigo title.
Title
for them,
that launched,
and
yeah.
And that kind of paced them for the 8 months or whatever
and
it was.
And it's just been released in... trade paperback.
Yep.
So this is written by Dan Abnett, who we've covered his stuff previously when we did things like Guardians of the Galaxy, and he's been recently writing things like Hypernaturals and so forth. So looking forward to... I've read most of that. I haven't finished it off yet. So
and I haven't read it yet, so I am actually very curious to read it.
I'll be looking forward to finishing it off and covering that next week. So we'll be coming back with that. Spoilers and all discussion. In the meantime, you can find us... here at behindthepanels.net. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/behindthepanels or on Twitter at behindthepanels. You can find us individually at various places. You can find me on Twitter at DVDBits. You can find Mr. Longo here at...
It's at Dave Longo.
There you go, at Dave Longo on Twitter. Also, and damngoodcup.com.
And I'm at David McVeigh or geekactually.com.
Excellent. So thank you all for joining us once again. We'll see you right back here in 2 weeks.
See you guys.
Thanks.
My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere behind the sea. She's there watching for me. If I could fly like